with another quick cup of knowledge. Joining me today is Dr. Stephen Jones, Assistant Professor of Small Animal Orthopedic Surgery at The Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Jones' research interests include joint kinematics and kinetics, and he is an educator in fracture management and repair here at the Oquendo Center. Thanks so much for joining us.
Of course.
And we're here at Oquendo today because we're part of the Principles of Fracture Repair Lab that you're teaching
right, with
Dr. Beal and some colleagues.
Yes.
We'll get to that a little bit more in a minute, but I'm always curious behind the why. What drove you into veterinary surgery?
Well, I'm from Ireland, so I grew up in a small town in rural Ireland outside of Dublin, and we always had dogs at home, and my uncle who lived nearby had a dairy farm and had lots of horses, so I was always surrounded by animals, and so that kind of drove my interest in animal care. And then I have another uncle who is a veterinary surgeon, and he specializes, or he emphasizes and specializes in orthopedics and does a lot of orthopedics, so seeing his patients go from being, I guess, very severely debilitated and very lame, going back to completely normal with a, you know, a surgical intervention really drove my passion for surgery.
Yeah. So we're going to talk today a little bit about orthopedics. And while we all may not be doing orthopedic surgery in our practice, orthopedics affects all of us,
right?
But I want to talk to you a little bit more about when a patient walks into our exam rooms, what are some signs we might see on physical exam or gait that cue us into the knee?
Well, I think, honestly, one of the first things that clues me into, you know, thinking about the knee is the history. So when the client comes in, the history can be very suggestive of the knee. As, you know, you probably have talked about with Dr. Beal, cruciate disease is the most common ailment of the knee. But of course, patella luxation, amongst others, are seen commonly. And the history can be very telling. For example, a dog with a torn cruciate tends to have a history of on and off lameness over a period of time before that lameness becomes more permanent, when the dogs are having partial tearing of the ligament and then it becomes a full tear. So even just hearing that history makes me think this is probably what's going on before ever seeing the dog or touching the dog or even watching the dog walk. Then patella luxation in itself can have a characteristic history where the owners might describe the dog as a skipping lameness. He'll walk along normally and all of a sudden he skips and holds his leg up. And again, that might clue me into thinking that it's, you know, the knee. Going back to the cruciate ligament disease, which is the most common disease that we see, they tend to be very severely lame. So they don't tend to be partially lame when they get a full tear. They become very lame, and that in itself can be very telling. If I see a dog in my exam room that doesn't want to put his leg down, it's uncommon that that would be something like a patella luxation or hip dysplasia. Most commonly, that's going to be a torn cruciate. And then just watching how the dog sits. A dog with a knee disease will not sit down nice and square like a normal dog will. They tend to kick the affected leg off to one side or tuck it underneath them. So again, seeing that in the exam room and hearing the history, all of those things put together can really clue us into thinking it's the knee before ever actually laying hands on the dog.
Those are all great tips.
Yeah.
On the patella, and you know, a lot of us are seeing quite a few small and toy breed dogs in today's world,
right,
and they're traveling all over with our clients. But many of them do have patella luxations of
right, varying
degrees. Tell me what your criteria is for surgical intervention, because they're not all surgically fixed. So
yeah,
help us understand that a little bit more.
I mean, that's a great question because, you know, so simply put, there are four grades, and grade four is the most severe grade, and grade one is the most, you know, the kind of the least affected, zero being normal. And in general, we tend to say grade threes and grade fours always need surgery, and then grade twos, they're a little bit in the gray zone. That being said, there are some dogs with grade three patella luxations that tend to be getting around and doing okay, and sometimes you have to make the decision based on the animal in front of you. How is that animal doing? Is the animal enjoying a good quality of life? Are the owners happy with that animal's quality of life? If not, then we obviously push them towards surgery a little bit more or make that recommendation. The grade two cases, they're a little bit interesting because we have, you know, we might see a grade two, a dog with a grade two patella luxation that has a skipping limb lameness once every 2 or 3 months. They're not going to surgery. But we may see another dog with a grade two lameness and they're every second step, they're holding their leg up. So that dog is much more clinically affected. And of course, we're going to recommend surgery much sooner in that dog than say the dog that's less affected. So ultimately the answer is look at the dog. Yeah.
Good information. Let's shift over to why we're here today again. So
right, a
lot of surgical techniques being learned and the principles of fracture repair. Can you elaborate a little bit more about what practitioners will learn when they come to this I would call a fundamentals course.
Yeah, that's really, the term fundamental says it all. We really want to give the veterinarian a basic understanding of the mechanisms of how a bone breaks, how it heals, to give them the principles of fracture fixation. You know, you can teach anyone on the side of the street how to put a plate on a bone, but that doesn't teach the veterinarian how, you know, how to address every individual case differently, because, you know, a fracture radius in a small breed dog is very different to a fractured radius in a Great Dane or a giant breed dog. So we really start with that, the fundamentals of how to approach a fracture, how to diagnose it, and how maybe to go through the decision-making process on how to fix it. And then the really nice thing about the labs here is that the attendees get a lot of hands-on. We do a lot of lab time. So, you know, even just this afternoon, they spent a full lab doing both plastic bone and cadavers for radius fractures. And then tomorrow we have basically a full day of labs. So the attendees really get a lot of time practicing the technique. So we can tell people what they need to do, but then they get to practice it on, you know, on cadavers and in plastic bones.
And that's so invaluable, right? We need the planning, and we also need that practice time.
Yeah, you can read it in the book till you're green in the face, but really it's not, you don't really get an appreciation for it until you do it. So practicing and being able to practice on plastic bones and then transfer that to cadavers before ultimately on a live dog is a very nice transition to learn the technique.
So all those techniques are going to be things that they take back to their practices, but they first have to identify the fracture correctly, right? Before we do all this planning.
Yeah.
I know that there are certainly cases where fractures may have been missed based on the wrong radiographic view.
Right.
So what's a common fracture that you find either missed or maybe misdiagnosed in general practice just based on the technique that we've chosen to try and see that view?
Yeah, I think that's, again, a great question, because it's something we do see from time to time. Is the most common misdiagnosis would be in young animals with open growth plates, open physis, and it's misdiagnosed as a fracture just because they're so young. And, you know, ordinarily when we look at radiographs, we're not seeing those open physis. So when we see an x-ray, there's maybe sometimes a tendency to over-diagnose a fracture. So just getting a textbook out and seeing what a physis should look like in a patient of that age can be very, very invaluable. I think the most maybe underdiagnosed fractures, again, would be in young animals with physial trauma, because the physis is a weak part in the bone, and they may get shifting and disruption of that physis, and you get very little radiographic change. And one of the things we really recommend to veterinarians to do if they're not sure is take a radiograph of the other side. We have an internal control, which is the opposite leg. Use that to your advantage, because even, you know, even when I'm looking at x-rays and I'm like, maybe there's something there, I'm not sure, I think it's really good to use the other leg and take an x-ray of the other side and say, yes, there truly is change, or no, maybe that's just age-related.
Good points. Yeah. I know we all, of course, want all of our fractures to be repaired properly and surgically, and that's what all of the practitioners here are going to be learning. But there are going to be veterinarians watching this today that say, you know, not every one of my clients can do an internal fixation on a fracture.
Right.
Are there any true indications for casting of fractures today? And when would you suggest a practitioner to allow that to be an alternative option?
Yeah.
For a fracture?
The answer is yes, absolutely. There are many fractures, you know, even in my practice at the university when I have cases coming in, where if I think external coaptation or casting or splinting is appropriate, that's what I will go for. The old mantra, a chance to cut is a chance to cure, is true, but certainly a chance to cut is also a chance to create a complication. So you got to be careful with that. And if you can treat an animal conservatively, you know, even as surgeons, we love to do surgery. If you can treat something conservatively, you should do. And certainly there are many fracture configurations that are amenable to external coaptation. In general, when we talk about that, we're talking about fractures that are distal to the elbow, so radius ulna fractures or metacarpal or digital fractures, or tibia fibula, so distal to the stifle, tibia or fibula fractures, and metatarsal fractures or digital fractures in the hind limb. So certainly there are some fracture configurations that are amenable to that. Not all fractures need to be surgically addressed. Yeah.
And any fractures of those areas that you would say I would not recommend casting, splinting, the external coaptation?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to the fracture configuration and then maybe even the, you know, the location. So for example, a fracture in the joint. We really recommend getting in there and addressing that fracture and reducing it anatomically and keeping it stably reduced so it can heal. Because if you don't do that, you're going to get severe arthritis or the development of arthritis in that joint. Also things like comminuted fractures or open fractures. In general, we try and stay away from them as far as external coaptation and get in there and stabilize them because there's no inherent stability. If you've got a comminuted fracture with lots of pieces, you're trying to hold something together that has no inherent stability, and you know often that's met with sort of suboptimal outcomes. That being said, if the owner just doesn't have the wherewithal, be it financial or emotional or whatever, to do surgery, certainly you know, we can try these things in cases like that and just warn the owners this may not go the way we would like. But we always try and do something for the animal to give them some comfort and give them the best chance of a good outcome.
And practitioners can get a lot of those techniques, again, here at the Oquendo Center at your Principles of Fracture Repair with your other colleagues. And there's also next year several of these courses offered in advanced course as well.
Yeah, and I think that's the way we try to do it, is get people to take the basic course, the fundamentals course first. Number one, they learn a lot of the fundamentals like we talked about. And then, of course, they get initially some hands-on experience with these implants, be it a bone plate and screws, be it you know, wires, lag screws, IM pinning, whatever it is, they get a feel for it. Then as they go back to their practice and start using some of these techniques, maybe they become a little bit more comfortable and want to expand their surgical skill set and maybe tackle some of the more challenging fractures. And that's why we then move to the advanced fracture fixation course. And I think we get a good broad, I think, overview of all the fracture configurations that are out there with those two courses.
Well, thank you so much for all of your education and time. No problem. I know the practitioners here today are loving this and look forward to all of the labs next year and teaching all these techniques to help so many patients out there in our practices. So thank you again for joining us.
Of course, thank you.